10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Live from Bournemouth, this is The Breakfast Show with Mal Krishnasamy on Teachers Talk Radio.
Good morning! It's 7 a.m. Welcome to The Breakfast Show. I'm Mal Krishnasamy. I'm here every Monday, 7 to 8.30 a.m. Coming up, we have special guests Adrian Rollins, Maria O'Neill, and Angela Brown. It's Monday morning. This is Teachers Talk Radio, and we are live.
Live from Bournemouth, this is The Breakfast Show with Mal Krishnasamy on Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live on the Podbean app or desktop player. Just head over to www.podbean.com/lsw/ttradio or search Teachers Talk Radio.
Welcome to the show. Hope people are feeling rested after the Easter break. I'm very aware that half the country is still on a break. I know my kids are still off for another week. So some of you are still on holiday. Why aren't you sleeping? Some of you are on the way to work. So how are you feeling right now? Today we're talking about quite a number of different things with some fantastic guests. But this, I have to talk about this weekend. This weekend, we had some amazing shows this weekend. I haven't even caught up with them all. I haven't caught up with them all at all. I mean, we've had a full weekend of amazing shows. We've had competitions. We've had people from all over the world calling in. We've had new hosts who've, well, it's like they've been doing it for years. It's fantastic. Now, you can listen live. Hopefully you are ready. Listening live via the website, www.ttradio.org, or you can listen back. So it's the same /listen back. So if you missed any of them over the weekend, do go back. There's been some absolute classics this weekend with some fantastic guests. So do listen back. Okay, so today, what are we talking about today? Well, first of all, I'd just like to say I've had about 2 hours sleep. 2.5 hours sleep. No, less than that, but 2 hours sleep. But why, you might ask? No, nothing to do with the kids. And this is the strange thing. Our kids are sleeping through and we seem to be going to bed later and later. And I blame Line of Duty. Now, not the new series, because we've never seen it before until this week. Well, until this time last week, we thought, oh, we'll whack on an episode of series one, see what it's like, because everybody's talking about it. Well, 4 episodes later, and then the following night, 5 episodes later, we're on to series 3 now. And I had to leave the other half and just go to bed because I knew I was coming on this show in the morning. But even still, I couldn't get to sleep. But it was like 4:30 in the morning. I haven't watched anything like this since 24. And 24, I had it on DVD, I had my laptop many moons ago. And it was like I only got out of bed to go to the toilet and grab something to eat. But I just wanted to keep watching. It was like really addictive. And that's what Line of Duty feels like. So if you haven't seen it and don't know what I'm talking about, watch it. It's fantastic. It's British TV at its best. Anyway, what are we talking about today? We're looking for another newsreader. That's the first thing. So if you know anyone that's interested, it's not that our beloved Tom Hopkins Burke, who's in the studio, it's not that he's leaving us. No, he's staying with us over and still doing his Saturday News Hour show on Saturday. and doing the news over the weekend. But to free him up to do that, we are looking for another newsreader for during the week. So do make contact via the website. There's been a lot of chat recently. Now, Gavin Williamson, our beloved Gavin Williamson, said something about how children have become much more undisciplined since lockdown. And I did wonder how many schools he'd been to. And I did wonder how a lot of parents felt about this, because I kind of felt a bit insulted. You tell me what you think. Do you think kids have become more feral since the first lockdown this time last year? Or have they come back calm and ready to learn? What do you think about Gavin Williams' statement? How do you feel as a teacher or as a parent? The other chat that I've seen a lot of this weekend is about exclusions. And there was only one tweet out of the hundreds I looked at that was a bit more nuanced. But everybody seemed to be quite black and white. Either go for no exclusions ever, or yes, we must exclude all the ones that are disrupting learning. I don't know what you think about this. I'd love to know your thoughts on this. I feel it's more nuanced than that, personally. One particular school I worked in, I was there for 8 years. We used exclusion as very, 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 very last resort. It was very rare that we did it. And where we were working, it was a very deprived area. High drug use, high alcohol use, or you name it, the area had it. And so there are a lot of troubled children, a lot of LAC, looked after children, a lot of children that we had, children that were just, refugees dropped off at the airport, because we were quite near Heathrow Airport, dropped onto a plane, come off at Heathrow Airport, and there's nobody there to greet them, that kind of thing. We've had child soldiers, so you can imagine what that's like, trying to teach them citizenship and expecting coursework off them. It's amazing they made it to school. So we had a lot of difficult, incredibly difficult children. But I can only remember of two or three instances where we permanently excluded children, and it was absolute last resort. And the main reason was because we knew that if we permanently excluded them, well, they were stuffed. that was it. That's it for their lives. What we did was ensured that each of the children that were at risk of being permanently excluded, they had a senior leader that was kind of like their mentor. And I think at the time I didn't think about it in that way. I just knew that certain kids were in my house, if you like, which was an eighth of the school. And anyone in there, I had their back, I had their corner. And if they messed up, they would follow me about and spend a day with me in my office. We've got Tom Hopkinsburg saying, we are asking the wrong questions. We should be thinking about how best we support kids who are excluded to make it a positive step forward for them, if that's possible. Investment into multi-agency support. The question of ending exclusions shouldn't really be on the table. They are needed as a last resort. That's exactly how I feel. Absolutely how I feel. And that's what we did at that school. So there were certain children, I do remember talking to my head teacher, and he's like, right, I think he's out, he's gone. And I'm like, no, one more chance, please. You know, I'll work with him. And we managed to get them through year 11. And I do remember being at one of the proms, a year 11 prom, a kid that on my first day at that school told me to, in no uncertain terms, which was the first time in my career. And he was, he came up to me and a bunch of other SLT and said, thank you so much. If it wasn't for you lot, I'd be in jail. And we were all standing there trying not to blub openly. But that's what it's all about, isn't it? Supporting the kids, helping them, just like Tom Hopkins Burke says, you know, finding different ways. And I feel like that isn't happening as much now. And I do wonder if that's all about targets. Oh, if we keep that child, maybe, maybe they'll ruin our stats. You know, what do you think? I mean, I do remember watching some program, and it's probably the last time we were, because both myself and my other half used to be teachers, and it's the last time we watched anything that was like Educating Wales or educating some area. So just we were watching it, and there was this kid that, yeah, troubled, very troubled, difficult life, but incredibly talented at art. And yeah, she acted out, and one scene the teacher was giving her a right rollicking, which type of rollicking, yeah, it's easy to be judgmental, but I think the teacher seemed to be out of his depth. Yeah, so it was like, okay, he's having a go at her. He's struggling to get her coursework in. And then next scene you see she's permanently excluded. And I have to say, I didn't sleep that night thinking about this kid, because I was thinking, what now for her? Because if she's not in school, she's going to be on that street. And on the street are all these gangs where they're just drinking alcohol and on drugs and up to mischief. And all that art that she was really good at, what happens to that? What happens to the rest of her life, basically? So, yeah. Is Tom Hopkins Burke right? Are we asking the wrong questions? What do you think? Why don't you call in? I've got a bit of an echo here. Our first guest is on his way into the studio. Adrian Rollins. We went to the same school in East London. Adrian, are you live?
Yes, I'm here. Good morning.
Morning. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks.
Yeah? Right, yeah. Just give us a quick rundown of your career.
Right. My first career is actually professional sports. I played professional cricket for 10 years.
Wow.
Mainly for Derbyshire and Northamptonshire. And then since then, I retired 2002/2003, and I've been teaching since. And I've taught all over the place. I've taught in Luton, I've taught in Northampton, London, Derby, and I'm currently in Nottingham as deputy head of a school.
Right, fantastic. So what type of school are you at?
Secondary academy, 11 to 19.
Right, brilliant. Now, we both went to Little Ilford School, didn't we?
That's right.
Which is now an outstanding school in Newham. My mum still lives across the road from the school, and she's been living there since 1974.
Wow.
How would you describe where we grew up?
I wouldn't say outstanding.
It was a very different school then. You were a year ahead of me, weren't you?
Yeah, it was interesting. You know, it's, you know, just the whole area was different. the expectations were not where they needed to be. But then for a lot of inner-city schools around the country, I know people talk about Ofsted, or I remember having inspections. I remember inspectors coming in for almost a week, if I recall. But in terms of the expectations...
See, I don't remember that at all.
Oh, yeah. I can't remember what they were. It wasn't under the banner of Ofsted, but I just remember them coming in for a few days. But not often. But, you know, the expectations were not particularly high. And, you know, you got what you got, and good luck to you. It didn't mean we didn't have career advisors. I had a career advisor. Well, there was one at school, but it wasn't, you know, the detail in terms of that wasn't particularly aspirational. Oh, you're good at maths, you could be an accountant, and that was kind of it. But yeah, it was, it was certainly indifferent, to say the least.
Yeah. What my memory of careers advice was this guy saying to me, "Do you speak any languages?" And I was like, "Yeah, I speak Tamil." And he said, "Well, that's not going to be any good, is it?" But actually, when I became a teacher, it was very useful, because it was the Sri Lankan refugees that came in, I was able to talk to their parents and stuff. So it actually ended up being very useful.
Well, there you go. In your face. But,
yeah. I'd like to see him now. Now, in terms of the education we received, I can't talk about the school. My brother and I talk about it. My brother was 6 years older than me. And whenever we talk about the school, we always giggle, because I just remember standing in corridors a lot, waiting for a teacher to turn up. And when they did turn up and we went inside, they'd go off again to, air quotes, photocopy. But they wouldn't come back with any paper. That's my lasting memory is just hanging out in corridors and just chatting to people in my form and that. What impact do you think that had on the school?
I think at the school there were teachers who tried really hard, who did their best. And there are others who, you know, I don't think because this is where people talk about the kind of pressure on teachers for outcomes. There's pressure, but ultimately it's about changing young people's lives. And I just think the whole culture of school has changed. And I think in that respect, in terms of particularly for children from inner city schools, it's changed, and it had to change. It shouldn't be a lottery in terms of what school you go in and the quality of the education that you receive.
I mean, when we were growing up, it was very clear that one particular school, Langdon School, wasn't it, was exceptional. But it was like, it felt like a different planet to where we were. That's what I remember.
100%. And then also the Catholic schools in the area were generally better, like we're St. Bond's or St. Angela's in particular.
Mm.
And then I probably recall there's one other school. I don't remember the name, but it was literally a lottery. I remember when I was at primary school, and I went to Avenue Primary, and I wanted to go to Rokeby because some of my mates were going there. I mean, but Rokeby at the time, I'm not sure now, but Rokeby at the time was not necessarily the school of choice, even in comparative to other schools in them. But that was the thing. I mean, I was fortunate in some respects that my mum was a governor at the school, and this was before she started teaching. And she eventually became chair of governors, but only by default. I spoke to her about this yesterday, only by default, because nobody else wanted to be it. So in that regard, there was a challenge at that level. But how it petered down, the quality that you got, it was just so, I would say, almost disparaging and just disheartening that, you know, some of these teachers who we won't names, who were deemed a laugh, you know, to a young person. And somebody, you know, we thought it was funny, but at the same time, we were being really seriously impacted by what was going on.
Yeah. Another memory I have is, I think it was a few weeks before our GCSEs. So this is 1989, probably around April, and being in a maths lesson, and I was in top set, though I couldn't work out why. I was in top set, because within the top set there was a top tier, and it was like the teacher just spoke to that particular table. And a few weeks before our exams, we were playing cards.
Yeah.
We were just sitting around playing cards. And I couldn't imagine anything like that now. And the teacher was busy doing something. And I just look back now thinking, we were like the most important, you know, cohort in the school. What was she so busy doing? And that's all I mean, like, I remember my biology lessons just, I mean, this is typical Asian kids around the table, and like the teacher would come in, say, copy out chapter 11, answer questions at the end. She'd walk back out again. And at the end of the 2 years, I had this massive folder, and I looked at it and thought, I don't know anything. But she was clearly too busy for us, yet we were doing our GCSEs. It's just... So in one sense, things have got better in terms of that accountability. But in another sense, I don't know. I think maybe it's gone too far the other way.
I think, it's questionable in terms of going too far the other way. It depends from in terms of performance management, because, I mean, the unions are involved in that process of performance management, in terms of it's not all about outcomes, and it shouldn't be all about outcomes. But it should be about what you deliver and what you give those children is something that's substantial and that they can take away. And sometimes they might not get it then, but they may get it, you know, a few years later. They may go to college and get it. So I don't think it should necessarily pin on one set of outcomes. However, if you think about, I don't know, I've worked in a school and I've worked in many schools where, so for example, say 50% of the students pass their maths, that's 50% leaving the school without it. And you've got to think, well, what's going to happen to those children? And I think the role as teachers, it's for some, I've worked in schools where they've said, I've challenged what we need to do and to need to improve standards. And they said, well, you don't know what it's like around here. And I've heard that from a head teacher. Where I've been told to drive around here and see what it's like. And I think that's an insult to the people in the community. And that's an insult to the fact that they should not be deprived of a quality education.
That's the typical thing I remember hearing in staff was, oh, you can't expect that from these kids. That kind of, it just, it's really upsetting, because actually those kids are from the same type of backgrounds as us.
Exactly. And that's what genuinely got my back up, because, when the adults give up on you, what do you have? You have yourself and you have your resilience. You may have, if you're fortunate, you've got a good network around you at home or your extended family that may help and have that expectations. And I would say in my case, I had that with my mum and my family. They didn't put pressure on me, but I saw people in my family achieving, and that told me that it was possible. But if I, you know, for those who didn't have that, who they may have been or may have had to be the first person to ever go to university, that's tough. That's tough when, you know, and I've also, like myself, I've worked school where I've heard, like, for example, a member of SLT saying, oh, that kid's going to go to prison or that one. And it's like, no.
And that's
the challenge that we face. You know, the overwhelming majority of teachers are so dedicated and so hardworking to this because it's hard work and people don't necessarily appreciate that. But we still have some who just do not, you know, which it's just a job. And teaching's not the thing which can be just a job, because I say to people, my preoccupation is my occupation. And that's what it is, because it's something that has to be part of who you are. It can't be just something you do. You can't just teach, because you're just teaching. You know, the students will understand that, and they'll know, because it's about relationships, and the strongest relationship you have in a school is with those students.
Yeah, and I have to say, some of my I know we're not supposed to have favourites, but some of my favourite children were the ones that were in trouble the most.
Yeah,
because you spent so much time with them. You spend a lot of time with the troubled children, because they're always in trouble, and just getting to know them is so important, so they feel like they've got a champion in a school. There's that TED talk, isn't there, about everybody needing a champion, and I think that's so true.
Yeah, Rita Pearson, isn't it? So the thing with that is, you know, there are a lot of children who have trauma, like adults have trauma, and sometimes our role is to help them unpick that. So they can go from trauma to triumph. And some students will come into school and they've got similar trauma to some of those kids who kick off, but they've found a way to do that, and others haven't. And that's like adults as well. There are adults who have challenges in life and still, you know, at my age can't unpick what trauma is and what their trauma is and how to overcome it. And our role is to help them unpick that, but at the same time, you know, make sure that they're giving themselves and other children a chance to get the best education possible.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Gavin Williamson has said that since lockdown, young people have lacked discipline. I think you feel the same way as me. Are you seeing that in your school?
No. I'm sorry, it's utter rubbish. It's like, yeah. In fact, the students have had to be more resilient than ever. You know, they've been through two considerable lockdowns where they've had to work from home. We've got children who are way more tech savvy than I am, and, you know, doing online learning, doing the work at home. And they're, you know, and some are facing challenges, like, for example, the school I'm at, where over 60% pupil premium, we've had issues with laptops. Students have come in with paper-based work, come in, took it home, brought it the next week. You know, young people are probably more resilient than adults. So, you know, to say that they've lost out or that that it's impacting them in a negative way, I disagree. That they've realised what they've had to do and they've picked up. Our students, I would say, you know, I'm very proud. And the way they've come back, you know, generally in the right frame of mind and focus and wanting to do well. We have the students who may have played up before, as every school has kids who misbehave, and they, you know, they may come back and try to carry it on. But obviously we have our expectations and we deal with that. But I've not seen that child has come out of lockdown and they're really, you know, they're not themselves. That has not happened at all. In fact, the young people are very resilient, very determined and want to do well. So I absolutely have, I can't relate to that statement at all. And I don't know where that information has come from.
Well, yeah, you have to wonder, don't you? Because everyone I speak to, and I've got teacher friends all over the country, and they're like, what, where's he getting this information? Has he gone into a school at all? Where is he seeing this idea of lack of discipline? But what an insult to parents as well.
Yeah, it is an insult to parents. Yeah. And they haven't caught with the kids. A lot of parents, you know, some parents have struggled with their children because now they realize what being a teacher is. You know, that might be one or two and we might have 30, but or 300 or 800 or 900 in an entire school. But at the same time, you know, so a lot of parents have actually now empathized with us. Some haven't, but a lot have empathized with us, and they do understand, and they've been supported because we had parents dealing with this as well, because they've either working from home, been furloughed, or are out of work. And so, you know, that's been a challenge in itself. And what I found in my experience is that the children have actually been, you know, being the more resilient in that situation and have helped keep their parents' spirits up, or vice versa. But either way, you know, a lot of parents would seriously refute that the students, their children have come back to school and are troubled. In fact, they've come back heads up, positive, working hard, determined to do well, because, you know, that comes from the fact that whatever the culture that the school drives, you come into our school, our culture is that you work hard and that you are kind to each other. That's our strapline as a trust. So, you know, it's about, you know, the culture that the school breeds will help feed what the children come in with anyway. So anyone who's had, for Gavin to say that it's not been the case, then that can only be the case where the school culture isn't driving that.
Yeah, I completely agree. So give me some lasting memories of Little Ilford School then.
Oh, wow.
Which teachers stand out? Give us some nice memories.
Yeah, Mr. Ging, PE teacher, absolutely stood out. Broad Geordie accent, just really dedicated to helping, always kind. And, you know, you didn't mess with him, but he was just so determined and hardworking. And he even made me do cross country club, which I didn't particularly enjoy, but he, you know, he cared. I mean, I came on Facebook 18 months ago, but he stayed in touch there. Mr. East, there was two Mr. Easts. There was a P and there was a sixth form Mr. East.
Sixth form Mr. East was very interesting.
Yeah, he was, he was just so passionate. He was so knowledgeable. He was so determined. I actually stayed in contact with him during the course of my cricket career. And sadly, he probably passed away about 8 years ago, but I'm still in contact with his family. He was an absolutely wonderful, wonderful man. And,
yeah, I just remember spending a lot of time in his office, just hanging around, chatting.
Yeah.
He had a lot of time for us,
And a lot of books.
Yeah.
A lot of books. I absolutely had a lot of time for him. I would say my head of year.
Actually, he's the one that came into the lower sixth form room and told us that Thatcher had resigned.
He probably would.
I remember that.
He probably would have been quite happy about that at the time.
Well, yeah, I think he was in shock. Yeah. We all were. We were like, what?
He would have been happy about that. Mm. But he was so passionate about life, really, and about young people. You could tell that by just how he communicated to you and how much he cared. Also, Mr. Edwards, who was my head of year, and I know there's been conversations, I think it was on Twitter, about how many people had, I think you might reference it, black teachers. So Mr. Edwards was history teacher, but also...
He was cool.
He was cool, yeah. And he was my head of year.
He was so cool, yeah.
He was the calmest guy in the... One of the calmest guys in the school, but one of the fiercest. When that You didn't want that red pen to come out of his pocket because you know what it meant. I don't like the attitude.
There are two, but yeah. Do you know, I just remember being... I think it was... I was in third year, year nine. And there'd been end of year tests or something and options were coming up and him just coming over to me and just saying, are you thinking about choosing history? And I was like, dunno. And he was like, I think you should. I was like, okay. I ended up becoming a history teacher. But it was all because he took the time to say, are you thinking of doing so-and-so? I was like, yeah. You know, somebody gave me a bit of attention. So I was like, okay, I'll do that then.
Yeah.
Yeah. I loved him. He was like shafted, wasn't he? he had that real cool dude look about him. Yeah.
Well, what people wouldn't know, he was actually, he's from Barbados. Mm. And my family's from Barbados. And he was actually friends with my mum.
Oh, really?
So I, away from school, I used to call him by his first name, which was Grant. And he lived. He lived at the top of Third Avenue, where Third Avenue met Church Road. So he lived there. Yeah. So often that's why, I don't know if you recall, he used to go jogging around the streets at various times of the evening and stuff like that. Very slowly, mind. But he was a very He used to actually tutor my brothers and I maths because he was a very good mathematician as well. So I knew him. So he was the one who encouraged me, my mum, for us to go Little Wilford rather than go to Rokeby, because a few of my friends from Avenue School were going Rokeby, and he said, no, because I'll be his head of year, so I'll watch out for him. So that's why I was very good. I didn't want him to go home and tell my mum that I'd not behaved.
Yeah. And that must have been great, having him as a role model.
Yeah, it was. It was. I mean, I hear from him now. He's retired. He lives in Barbados. But some friends from my year group actually stay in contact with him, and he contacts me via WhatsApp, and we check in probably once every couple of months, 2-3 months. But he was a good role model. You know, I can never forget him now. His professionalism and his dedication. You know, he was very dedicated. He was one of those dedicated, hardworking teachers. And very serious about what he did. So, and I'm very grateful for that.
Yeah. Well, next time you're in touch, if you could tell him that due to him giving me that attention, I became a history teacher for 20 years. Because that moment changed my life. It really did. It's amazing.
Yeah.
You know, because I hadn't even thought about choosing history at all until he came over to me and mentioned it in a lesson.
Well, so, I don't know if you recall the head of history, Mr. Jeffries.
He was my GCSE teacher and I loved him. I absolutely loved him.
He always used to say, I'm the second best teacher in the school. we're the second best class in the school, because he always said there's always someone better than you. So just say you're second best. Because I had him for GCSE history as well. And he was a wonderful man. He passed away quite young, really, in his 50s. Had a heart attack. He was absolutely another wonderful man.
Something he said during my GCSEs I've never forgotten, and that he showed us a file. I was always hanging out with teachers. he showed me this huge folder and he goes, I could tell you what I taught this time last year. And he had this, all his schemes of work, all his lessons, but I'd never seen anything like it, because if you compare him to some of the other teachers, yeah. You know, he was so, his planning was amazing. And that always stuck with me, that he could just improve and develop his lessons and that. And that was, to me, unusual seeing that, because I never saw any other teacher with plans, or it didn't look like they, you know, had an idea about the curriculum or anything like that. It was only him and my English teacher. Do you remember Mr. O'Sullivan?
Yeah, Mr. O'Sullivan, yep.
Yeah,
the staff had a cricket team.
Yeah, my brother was in that cricket team, I think.
Yeah. Oh, who's your brother again?
Chan Krishnasamy, Chandran.
Yeah. Well, when I was in sixth form, I played for the staff cricket team. I was drafted in, funny enough, because they played occasional Sundays.
Yeah.
So Mr. O'Sullivan was the captain. And there was a lot of, Mr. Farquhar, Mr. Mirza, the Mass Mirza.
A Mass Mirza.
There was two Mirzas. There was Mirza and there was Mirza, wasn't there? So Mr. Mirza played.
So I was
drafted in to play some of these schools and do all the batting, do all the bowling and do all the wicketkeeping.
Yeah, I remember, because my brother used to play cricket every Sunday with everyone, and I'd go down with my dog and just watch and hang out with the teachers. I'd forgotten about that, actually. It was just, it was nice. It was nice. Yeah. Well, thanks so much for coming in, Adrian.
No problem.
We must talk again, and please let Mr. Edwards know that you changed my life.
I will then. I'll pass on
the regards. Okay, speak soon.
Thanks, Mal. Cheers.
Right, bye.
Bye.
Okay, so we've been talking about, what have we been talking about? Adrian and I have been reminiscing about school days, some of the wonderful teachers we had. We had some fantastic teachers, but we also had some dodgy ones too. And like I said, I do remember standing around in corridors, just hanging out. We weren't bad kids. It was an interesting school, though. It was quite an interesting school. Oh, something flashed up and I missed it. Oh, what was that? What could that be? I don't know. Anyway, okay, so coming up, we have got the news of Tom Hopkins' book.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News with Tom Hopkins' book.
This is Tom Hopkins-Burke with your Teachers Talk Radio News. University vice-chancellors and students have accused the government of having left out students from their roadmap out of lockdown. Universities had expected to fully reopen their campuses this week, along with pubs and gyms, but the government has refused to set a return date for face-to-face teaching. Universities UK, the National Union of Students, and the mental health charity Student Minds have written a joint letter to the government calling for certainty for students amid concerns about their mental health and well-being. The Department for Education said that the government was committed to getting all students back into university as soon as the public health situation allows. The Scottish Qualification Authority has been criticised for its incredibly complex appeal system for this year's exam results. Gina Wilson, the Children and Young People's Commissioner Scotland's Head of Strategy, said that the SQA's consultation was challenging to complete for the young people whose views it sought. The consultation lasted for just 2 weeks, while Scottish Government guidance says that a consultation process should last 12 weeks. Final grades in Scotland will be based on teacher estimates and a quality assurance procedure overseen by the SQA. Students in Northern Ireland have returned to school this week as part of a limited easing of lockdown restrictions. Education Minister Peter Weir said that the priority must be to keep our schools safe and ensure they remain open. He added that he would continue to invest in resources to help pupils who have faced disruption to their learning. Teachers Talk Radio is looking for a new weekday newsreader. Register your interest by emailing teacherstalkradio@gmail.com. or messaging at TTRadio2021 on Twitter. That's your Teachers Talk Radio News with Tom Hopkins-Burke.
Morning, morning, morning. So some of you are probably listening to this from your bed or having a cup of tea. Some of you are on the way to work already. Some of you have another week at home. So we've been looking at Gavin Williamson's statement. That basically he's saying that kids are undisciplined since being for the last year being on lockdown at home with their parents. And children have become feral since the first, not his words, my words. That's basically what he's saying. Children have become more feral. Now, Adrian Rollins, he was saying at his school he's not seen any evidence of that. What about you? Have you seen evidence of that? Have you seen, I'm going to have to say with my kids, who are pretty, my own children, that is, are pretty disciplined as it is. But they were, I didn't actually want them to go back to school. But the day of them returning, when we went to go and pick them up, the looks on their faces, both of them were beaming, absolutely beaming. There's nothing like being around your peers. You know, as much as mum and dad are fun to be around, there's nothing like hanging out with people your own age. And being around school and being around all those different people. So they seemed quite grateful to be back at school. And what do you think? Why don't you call in? One thing I didn't mention is that if you call in, you have the possibility of winning the Teachers Talk Radio mug. No? Are we not feeling that? No? Come on, it's a mug! I think next should be teeth spoons, because they're always missing in the staff room, don't they? Yeah. So, yes, if you call in, if only one of you calls in, well, that mug is yours. Somebody's calling in now. yeah, that mug is yours. Put your names in and pull your name out of a hat. So, hello, you are connected. No, I can't hear anyone. Let's see if they... Hello? Hello, you're live on Teachers Talk Radio. No, I don't know. Let's see if they can sort out their... They can, yeah. Oh, they've gone now. Oh, never mind. It might be Maria. Okay, so hopefully, Maria, you've got headphones. That's the last thing I said to you last night. So, coming up, we have Maria O'Neill talking about pastoral care. What would you like to ask her? Okay, you're welcome to call in. That you could win a mug. Yeah, you could win a mug. They're beautiful. A Teachers Talk Radio mug could be yours if you call in and talk to us about exclusions. Is it as black and white as we should never have exclusions, or should we say, get them out, we don't want them? Or is it much more nuanced than that? I'm sure it is much more nuanced, but Twitter isn't a very nuanced place, is it? Yeah. What do you think? Why don't you call in? You could win a mug. Call in, people, call in. You can text, you can tweet on tagging in at TT Radio 2021. you can Facebook us, you can do all kinds of things, really. There's a million different ways of getting in touch, but do call in and give us your thoughts on exclusions. And what Gavin Williams has been talking about in terms of have kids become more feral since lockdown, the very first lockdown. What do you think? Are you seeing evidence of that, or are you seeing evidence to the contrary? Yeah. Later on, at 8 o'clock. We've got Angela Brown coming in. And we're going to be talking to her about human first, diversity, equity and inclusion. Okay, so that'll be interesting to find out what she means by human first. We've also got Maria O'Neill coming in to talk about her new book on practical pastoral care, and her book launch is this week. So, her book launch is this week. Okay. So, today, what have we been talking about? We've been talking about a number of things. What's been in the news? What's been, there's been a lot of talk about Prince Philip passed away, sadly, over the weekend. And there's been a lot of talk about him, his personality and so on. But a lot of people I know have said that their lasting, what they found, his lasting legacy is the Duke of Edinburgh Award. And it'll be interesting to hear your views. What impact, those of you, unfortunately, I don't remember there being a Duke of Edinburgh Award when I was at school, wasn't involved in it. But how did that impact you, if you personally did that as a child? And or when you were younger, because I know sixth formers do it as well. Or how have you seen it impacting the young people in your communities? What difference has it made? We've got somebody calling in. We've got Rourke's Drift. Condolences from the, I can't see that flag, what that flag is. Is that America? The USA, okay. Wow, fantastic, thank you. Hey, Maria, are you, we've got Maria in the studio. Are you wearing headphones? Oh, I can't hear you very well. I think I can hear you. Hello, Maria. Oh, I can just about hear you. You're really faint. You're incredibly quiet. Oh, there you are. Speak. Are you there?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Yay.
I can see you coming in and coming out and coming in and coming out. And I was like, oh, my God, what's going on? How are you?
Just technology problems first thing in the morning.
Yeah. Okay, let's start off with Maria O'Neill. This is your life. So tell us, what, give us a rundown of your career so far.
It's been a straightforward career that I thought I would have. It all started quite early. I was promoted to co-head of department very early on in my third year of teaching. Then I wanted to become an AST, which I did, advanced skills teacher. And yeah. I was responsible for teaching and learning, assessment. I led an assessment group, like school development groups that we used to have at the time. So I really enjoyed having the responsibility and making the difference at that level. And then I had two children.
Yeah.
And I'm sure some people will relate, some women will relate. I did have to take a step back. And that meant that I just went in as head of department. And then since then, to be honest, my career has taken quite a pastoral turn. So I have been applying for more and more pastoral responsibilities. And sort of fast forward to now, I am responsible for pastoral curriculum. I am volunteering for NSPCC as a childline counsellor, and I'm also writing my PhD on digital wellbeing. So it has become very pastoral.
Yeah, and we've been in touch for a number of years, and you seem very busy between your PhD, getting involved in wellbeing things, and now you've got this book coming out. Now, can you tell us a bit more about this book, please? What prompted you to write the book?
Things have prompted me to write the book. First of all, I was at a stage where my son has been quite poorly in terms of mental health, and he attempted suicide. Oh. And it hit Sorry me really hard.
Yeah.
He was 16 at the time, and I just was looking for help everywhere. Mm. And as people would know who are working in the pastoral world, CAMHS is overwhelmed. But even if you did get through to CAMHS, it doesn't necessarily guarantee the success that the young person will connect with the senior nurse or with the counselor, whoever you get. There was a day, I remember, I was quite desperate for someone, and I phoned the doctors, and they said, look, if he gets worse, just phone the ambulance and the police. And I think at that stage, I realized that I was pretty much on my own. I thought we can do so much more to stop young people from getting to that point. I'm going to continue my research for the PhD, and I'm going to find out what can be done to be proactive in our pastoral care. So
yeah.
As I was doing my PhD and research, and I just thought, okay, this is so much knowledge, and this is the knowledge that could help maybe parents, maybe pastoral leaders, and that's why I wanted to put it in the book, to share with everybody and to encourage everybody to be not just reactive in terms of safeguarding, you know, child protection and safeguarding, obviously they are very important, but actually to stop young people from going to that point of almost no return.
So what do you think this book you've written, how do you think it could help practitioners in school?
First thing is looking at the structure, the pastoral structure, is looking at the culture of the school, is looking what can be done, how can we embed the values, the ethos, how can we bring the community together. There are different chapters. I start with explaining what well-being is, because it has become quite an empty word this day. I wanted to bring back the meaning to the well-being, because, you know, philosophers debated this for centuries. I went back to the Greek philosophers and ancient Greek philosophers, the Chinese philosophers, to see what the debate was at that time. So it has been a very popular and a very debated topic, because at the end of the day, we all want happiness. This is just simplified. I explain how to introduce staff to well-being, how to deliver CPD, because, if we expect staff to deliver mental health or pastoral training to young people, they need to have the knowledge themselves, and there has been some inconsistency in delivery across the board. Then I talk about the building parental engagement involvement, because parents are responsible for the safeguarding of their children and for pastoral care, but to engage them in pastoral care has been quite tricky. Because, you know, they are more interested. I'm not just saying that everybody, but the research has shown that there has been much more interest in the academic progress rather than the pastoral area of the development. So, yes, I'm trying to bring everything together.
Hello? Oh, you keep coming in and out there, Maria. Oh, you're back again. Oh, I think you've gone.
So talk about the formal and informal way of looking at pastoral curriculum. That's for professionals to look at. And PSHC is becoming, more and more topics within the PSHC are becoming compulsory as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So if we're looking at that situation with your son, if that happens now in a school, what could be done?
I haven't noticed, and most of the time at schools, and I saw him at the weekend, and I noticed that he was more subdued, that he wasn't opening up, that he wasn't communicating, and I did reach out to school. But I think that noticing period is very important, and staff need to be aware of these signs. We need to work in collaboration, not putting guilt on anybody, but I think, that collaboration was missing from no one's fault. But we do need to work together a bit more and to notice things together, because things that they might have noticed, I have, and the other way around. He did spend quite obviously from Monday to Friday at school. And it's difficult. It is difficult. School's under so much pressure with all the academic stuff. But I think, the issue is that the pastoral training is missing. The pastoral training within the teacher training, initial teacher training, and afterwards as well. Tutors are the main people who are the first port of call, who do notice things, or who have got the ability to notice. They should see the children every morning.
I always used to say that form tutor is the most important job in the school because of that connection with the children every day and the connection with home as well. You're like the bridge between school and home.
100%, and that's why it's really important to establish that connection and to train our tutors as well, because we seem to forget about training the pastoral leaders lower down that hierarchy table.
Yeah, and I have to, when thinking back to my PGCE, I don't remember anything about pastoral care at all. We had the subject specific stuff. There was one lecture on behavior management, which thinking back now is quite laughable. We hadn't been inside a classroom yet, so it was hard to imagine the things the person was saying, but nothing about pastoral care and nothing on PSHE either, which was when I first started PSHE. I was suddenly told, oh, you're doing PSHE with year 9, 10, 11. It was a complete shock. I didn't know that I was going to be doing that. And there was no training at all.
At all. And I think maybe things are moving a little bit now, but from people I'm speaking to, it's still quite a lot of work to be done in that area in terms of raising the status of pastoral training and raising the status of pastoral leaders within the school as well.
Yeah. Absolutely. Now, where can we find out more about this useful book you've written?
It's on Bloomsbury website. It's also on Amazon. If you just Google proactive pastoral care, I do come up, and I have got a few tweets pinned to my timeline as well. I am at Maria O'Neill. Instead of a no, it's a zero. Maria O'Neill. On Twitter, so if anybody would like to connect, that will be brilliant.
Okay, fantastic. Thanks so much for coming in, Maria. I'll speak to you soon.
Speak soon, take care.
Hang on, I'm not speaking to you on Thursday. Is it this Thursday? You've got your book launch, haven't you?
Yes.
Well, I'll see you then.
Take care. Thank
okay,
you
bye.
Bye, bye.
Right. Right, big thank you to Maria for coming in. Now we've got the news. So after the news, we've got the wonderful Angela Brown coming in. So let's hear it for the news. Tom Hopkinsburg with the news.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News with Tom Hopkins Burke.
This is Tom Hopkins Burke with your Teachers Talk Radio News. University vice chancellors and students have accused the government of having left out students from their roadmap out of lockdown. Universities had expected to fully reopen their campuses this week, along with pubs and gyms, but the government has refused to set a return date for face-to-face teaching. Universities UK, the National Union of Students, and the mental health charity Student Minds have written a joint letter to the government calling for certainty for students amid concerns about their mental health and well-being. The Department for Education said that the government was committed to getting all students back into university as soon as the public health situation allows. The Scottish Qualification Authority has been criticised for its incredibly complex appeal system for this year's exam results. Gina Wilson, the Children and Young People's Commissioner Scotland's Head of Strategy, said that the SQA's consultation was challenging to complete for the young people whose views it sought. The consultation lasted for just 2 weeks, while Scottish Government guidance says that a consultation process should last 12 weeks. Final grades in Scotland will be based on teacher estimates and a quality assurance procedure overseen by the SQA. Students in Northern Ireland have returned to school this week as part of a limited easing of lockdown restrictions. Education Minister Peter Weir said that the priority must be to keep our schools safe and ensure they remain open. He added that he would continue to invest in resources to help pupils who have faced disruption to their learning. Teachers Talk Radio is looking for a new weekday newsreader. Register your interest by emailing teacherstalkradio@gmail.com or messaging at ttradio2021 on Twitter. That's your Teachers Talk Radio news with Tom Hopkins Burke.
Morning, everyone. Welcome to the Breakfast Show at Teachers Talk Radio. We've had two wonderful guests on already. And now I'd like to introduce, let's get rid of that. I'd like to introduce Angela Brown.
Hi, Mal. Morning,
pal. Welcome.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good. Your rock music is quite rocky, isn't it?
This time yeah. It has to be, otherwise I'll be asleep anyway.
I'm loving your vibe.
Yeah, thank you. How are you?
I am just peachy now that the tech situation is sorted. Yeah, I'm good. Yeah. I'm really good. It's a beautiful day here this morning. Sunny Denmark. It's lovely. Yeah.
Lovely. Denmark has been voted one of the best places in the world to live, apparently.
I'll vouch for that.
Yeah?
I will vouch for that wholeheartedly. I've been here for about 18 months now. And it's just delightful. It's just really, really delightful. I can't quite put my finger on what it is, but I don't know about happy, but it's definitely delightful.
Yeah, sounds chilled.
It's very do I sound chilled?
You sound chilled. Yeah. You always sound chilled though, to be fair. Tom Rogers says the rock music is very 70s. How very dare you.
Very 70s, but then we are a bit 70s.
We are a bit 70s, yes. We are a bit.
Dare I say it?
Enough said about that. Okay, give us a quick rundown of your career.
Okay, so I trained as an English teacher in Bristol about 22 years ago, and worked in the middle of Bristol in a city school. Absolutely loved it. And then I quite quickly became interested in or good at working with young people who were failing to thrive in mainstream. And so I was in the mainstream. I was, you know, obviously teaching English in the mainstream school, finding myself working with lots of oh, as they would be called at the time, naughty boys, which was not really accurate. And we were given the opportunity to set up a unit for children who were finding it difficult to thrive in the mainstream provision. So I became head of that, and then I moved on to become assistant head for that kind of alternative provision, special educational needs team. And then I did something that I didn't ever think I was going to do. I stepped out and I went to become a deputy head of a federated brand new school for SEMH and the pupil referral service, what had been the pupil referral service in South Gloucestershire. And then very quickly ended up becoming head of the pupil referral service. So working with children who had complex mental health needs, children who were in the key stage 3 and 4 PRUs, and supporting the behaviour support team. So I've ended up in these sort of slightly peripheral roles, I guess, where I was kind of on the edge of mainstream all of the time, often advocating for young people, often advocating for families. And I think I quite liked it because I think I felt like I was a bit of an outsider often, or I wasn't quite the mainstream. So it kind of suited me. And I then moved into an even more peripheral role. And that a headship came up, a headship that I'd kind of dreamed about. And I'd been, for all of you Wee Wee fans out there, I'd been putting it on my vision board. And I had been dreaming of having a school that would really attend to the more holistic needs, as I saw it, of children that were failing to thrive. And so those were things like making sure that they had opportunities to use their hands to do craft. Arts are really important to me. Making sure that alongside the kind of focus on how they were developing their brains, that they were also developing this really kind of wholesome heart dimension of themselves, this ability to work with others and to communicate and to support other people. So I'd been vision boarding this school and thinking this would never exist how would this ever exist in state funded circles? Because I'm really, really committed. I was really, always really committed to working in the state system, just because I'd worked in some really deprived areas and felt like I could make a contribution. And I always say I found myself pregnant, which isn't quite true because you just don't find yourself pregnant. Anyway, I became pregnant.
Immaculate conception.
Unfortunately. And so I became pregnant, and I was 4 months pregnant, opened the tests, and there it was, the job that I had been dreaming of. The headship of a new school that was going to be state-funded Steiner School, which would allow me to do all of the things that I dreamed about, and that was going to be not somewhere out in a leafy suburb, but right in the heart of East Bristol, which is the area that I'd always worked in. So it was an offer too good to pass up. I applied, and I obviously couldn't start the job at the time that they wanted me to, because I was probably going to be giving birth at the point that they wanted me to start the job. So I went for it anyway.
Slightly busy. Yeah,
it was probably not going to be the best time to start a headship at that moment. But I went for it anyway. And and I was, I just sort of feel like I always ought to say this bit just for those people who listen and are thinking about maternity leave or thinking about what's going to happen if I, you know, what happens if you want to be ahead and you also want to have kids. And I went to the interview and I wasn't kind of visibly, you know, I wasn't showing like I could, you know, I was pregnant, but I wasn't showing. And I knew that I was kind of going to get through to the next stage. I just had that feeling in the interview. So at the end of the interview, I just thought, I'm going to send them an email and say, I'm pregnant and I'm not going to be able to start this job. And although you can't probably legally eliminate me from the proceedings. Mm. I want to give that openness. And I also want to give you the opportunity to find somebody that's the right person, because it would be really unfortunate for a school to invest loads of time and effort in finding somebody that, you know, then wasn't going to be able to start the job. And anyway, long story short, they went with it and they progressed me on and I got the job. So I spent 3 years there doing something that was really, really hard work, being a, being a mum and being a head of this school, but really exciting. And at the end of that phase, I sort of left for a variety of reasons, but mainly because I think it needed taking to the next level of its evolution. And I kind of felt like with a young child, actually, headship was really hard. I thought, I'm going to stop being a head. No sooner had I said those words than an ex-colleague of me phoned me up and said, I don't suppose you fancy being an interim head, do you? literally.
Yeah.
I handed my notice in and got another headship immediately afterwards. And then spent a couple of years working in South Gloucestershire. So worked in a secondary, large secondary school there, and then as deputy CEO of the trust. And I left there, left that trust 18 months ago, absolutely loved working in South Gloucestershire, loved working in Bristol, but increasingly become interested in coaching and working with other people who were really keen to get into leadership and who often would contact me and say, oh, how do you do it then? How do you do being a mum and being a head? How do you do, like, as a black woman, how do you get that, how do you get onto that leadership team as a woman, how do you kind of break through when all of the people leading in the school are men? And I've become really interested in this area, and I'd been coaching women who were asking those questions and also delivering training for women who were really keen to get through and break through into leadership, and for colleagues who were from ethnic minority groups who were wanting to do the same. And I basically kind of gave up full-time work in education 18 months ago and just ploughed into this field, which is what I do now. So I'm a coach and I am a diversity, equity, inclusion consultant working with organisations.
Well, that really last bit, I was going to ask it. It's really short. Yeah, really it was just short. 12 minutes. Yeah. It's fine. I
mean, if anyone wants the long version, please reach out.
There's a longer version.
There's a really long version. But it does involve cups of tea and scones and all that kind of stuff.
Now, I was going to ask you, because I've known you for a while now, and I've seen an evolution of, you know, we've had chats about you thinking about leaving schools full-time, and now I see another evolution, and I love that you use a word that I hadn't really heard before, luminary. And you seem to have moved more into the DEI area.
Yeah, so I was sort of doing it, but I never was calling it that. So back when I worked in that first school, I, as well as being the person who kind of supported the young people who were not thriving in the mainstream, I was also the diversity, equity, inclusion lead. And so I've always had this, I've had an interest in it. But as you know, Mel, I've had a long standing battle with myself, really, around being a person who, just because I'm black, does that mean I have to always be the person that's the diversity, equity, inclusion person?
Yeah.
And so it's been a really, it's been quite a difficult birth, actually, to get to the point where I'm able to say I'm a DEI consultant, because it felt like I didn't want to be that person. I just wanted to teach at certain times, you know. I wanted to be a deputy head. I wanted to be a head. I didn't want to have to be the person that did it. But increasingly found that I was doing it anyway. You know, I ended up with people gravitating towards me who really, really needed me to speak on these matters, who really wanted to hear my perspective on it, because they were really struggling in their schools often. This is before I started working with organisations other than schools. And the more I realised I used my voice to talk about my experiences, but also to talk about what I felt organisations should be doing, and also, you know, really supporting people through coaching, but by not pretending that the systems were fair, because, you know, lots of people I coach have been coached into thinking that it's just their talent that's at question. Rather than the fact that they're a woman with two children. Yeah. And that the school doesn't want to employ them because they're worried about, you know, them leaving early. So I felt like there are some things that we say about education that I really believe. I do believe it's a vocation, but I also believe that human beings have a deeper calling. I think we all have a calling to do something. And I was kept ignoring this. Could you talk on this, Angie? Could you be this person? Could you speak on our behalf? Could you motivate? Could you coach? Could you encourage? I kept ignoring it because I thought, I don't want to be that person. And then I had a coaching session. I had a number of coaching sessions, and kind of over a period of time realised that perhaps that was my calling. Perhaps that was my responsibility. Perhaps that was something that I was here to do. And as soon as I lent into that possibility, it just became much easier, and it became very natural. So yeah, I've kind of morphed into it, but feel like it's a realization of something that I'd been doing all along, just properly articulated. And I do talk about it quite a lot now.
Good. Well, it's nice that you've embraced it rather than fighting it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, you mentioned to me that you'd like to talk about human first diversity, equity and inclusion. Could you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, I think when I talk about doing diversity, equity, inclusion work, I think of it really as a way of doing things and a way of doing life, rather than doing a series of things, rather than doing a series of activities that constitute diversity, equity and inclusion. And I think if you see it as a gesture, if you see having a lens that's always really open and interested in diversity, and having a lens that is really, or a gesture rather, that's really committed to equity in the world, being a person that's really committed to that, just looks around and thinks, yeah, this is something that I want to be alive for me. Having a gesture of inclusion, of wanting it, of, you know, being in situations where you just, it naturally feels like that is your gesture. That becomes a way that we do things. And it very much creates a human first rather than activity first way of being. Because we are naturally interested in the well-being, in the best experiences, in the reaching out to other human beings. And the reverse of that, for me at least, with this kind of work, is where we start with activities that, by virtue of the nature of activities, because they don't always include humans, they don't always include connection, make people feel like they're not included, make people feel a level of hurt or disruption or discomfort that then doesn't move this whole ambition for, basically, for better societies, right? For people to feel like they can genuinely contribute and are genuinely part of, that doesn't move that mission further forward. So for me, the work starts with human beings, and it's a really important part of the way that I work. And it's not to excuse anything, because I always get this kind of feeling that people think I mean, oh, okay, well, we just make everyone feel comfortable then, shall we? And I really don't mean that, because I think there are high levels of discomfort when it comes to really hearing somebody, when it comes to really sitting with somebody and listening and being with them and understanding their perspectives. I think there are high levels of discomfort. I think it's really complex work. I don't think it's easy, and I don't think it lets people off the hook. But I do think that we need to start this work with humans, as humans, and not with activities, not with surveys, and not with tasks, and not with activities that diminish the humans involved in the situation.
Okay. And so If we're looking at that, how would that manifest itself within schools?
So I work in a way that is, as you know, I'm an English teacher.
Mm.
And I love to start with, I really believe in the power of narrative.
Mm.
So most of the time I am connecting individuals to their narratives and trying to understand the story that they bring to the situation, and then trying to understand, trying to bring about, trying to articulate, trying to birth, if you like, the collective story then. So I'm Angie and I have a story, and you're Mal and you have a story.
Mm.
And we probably have an idea about each other, or a set of judgments that we might have about each other, a set of assumptions we might have about each other. And until we're in a situation in which we can share our stories, we won't necessarily recognise the commonalities. And so part of the work is that I literally make people come and bring selected stories to the table, and this is all kind of quite structured work.
Mm.
And there's something about commonality, but there's also something about what happens when we tell our stories, when we reveal parts of our narrative, is that it opens us up to listening to each other without defence.
Yeah.
Something very disarming about having to reveal a dimension of yourself, which means that you are put in a position of being able to really be open to another person's reality. So what I've seen work really well in organisations is when there is a democracy about storytelling. So we don't just have one dimension. We don't just promote one protected characteristic, if you like. We don't just hear about one identity. We hear about a kind of tapestry of multiple identities. We hear about the intersections of identities.
Mm.
And in the process of that, what you see is a kind of growing realisation from human beings about what the damage they are responsible for is in the lives of other people, what the harm they could cause is in the lives of other people, as well as what amazing, incredible benefits they can bring to a situation. So I do, I do a mixture of things, but I'm really, really interested in how in organisations we create space at first, in the first instance, to hear each other speak. And then we talk as we're working in schools. Schools also have a story. So then we begin to talk about the story that we have. And that's really kind of, that can be quite difficult for lots of schools. You know, what is the story is something that we then understand through some of those activities that I was saying we don't start with. So we understand the story of a school through talking to our parents. We understand the story of a school through thinking about our perception in the community. We understand the story of a school through asking our children and young people. We understand the story of a school through talking to our staff about their experiences of working in that organisation. Mm. So the story of the school begins to emerge, and then the work that I feel is really luminary is then about asking the question, what story do we want to tell? What story do we want to be told about who we are and what we're doing? And that's when we start to plan the work.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? Because like with many schools, it's a case of trying to sweep stuff under the carpet and then start again.
Yeah.
But like you say, unless you understand what's happened before, you can't really plan for the future.
No. And that stuff is a bit like, you know, when we all, if you think about your own life and you think about the times that you've tried to sweep under the carpet something in your own story, it doesn't work. It just pops up in another guise. So often I work in organisations where things have been swept under the carpet, or things, you know, we don't talk about those things. And it lives on in the memory. So it lives on in the memory of the organisation. So those people who have felt the injustice of oppression, of institutional oppression, will hold that memory for as long as they are there. And when they're not there, that exists in the memory, but then slightly contorted and slightly twisted by time and by other people. And so I think it can be quite dangerous, actually, for organisations to ignore that story as though they are not living, breathing things in their own right. And actually, there's something incredibly brave about just embracing it and saying,
This kind of reminds me of that film, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I think I've forgotten which is part of the film, isn't it?
Yeah, it's Jim Carrey and what's the name from Titanic? And where they had that's it. Yeah. So they have a relationship, they break up. And so what she does, I think she does it first. She goes through this process of erasing him from her memory, and he does the same thing. But then they end up gravitating towards each other again. And it is that sense of actually they haven't, you know, by erasing that, they haven't learnt from it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's although you erase the pain, you can't erase it. It's not right to erase the learning from a situation.
No. Yeah. And there's something really, really powerful about kind of atoning for things. And there's something really moving for individuals who have worked in systems that have oppressed them, or in structures that in which they felt oppressed, just having it be recognised. It's not like you have to do anything. I think sometimes I wonder about this fear of kind of litigious behaviour or something, like what it is that really prevents people from just owning that, because there's something so powerful in the healing of that when an institution is able to say, gosh, we really got this wrong. We really got this wrong, and we see the damage this has caused, and we're really committed to changing this story and to getting it right. That's just such powerful work.
Yeah, and that can only happen if you talk to each other.
Exactly. Yeah.
I've got Class One Probe saying someone that should be designing what education should look like. I think that means you.
Oh, well, that's incredibly nice if that does mean me.
That is very nice.
Do my best.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because sometimes it's something my partner and I always say. Should I say fiance? But like my partner, I
just
know.
Didn't know whether to say on the
show.
No,
I know.
No,
I'm just getting used to that.
Hang on a minute. Let's just have a little mic drop moment there. Can we just say massive congratulations?
Thank you very much. It just, you know, it came out of the blue, 15 years, and just like
very happy about that, popping the question.
I think he had his COVID jab that day, and I think he thought he was going to die or something. Okay. So he thought he'd need a live-in nurse. He actually proposed. Yes. Oh. So what was I saying? I don't know. It's gone now. I've no idea. I've lost it now.
We're lost in the moment.
That's what I was saying. Yes, sometimes you have to leave schools in order to make more of a difference within schools. Would you agree?
Well, I guess it's a different vantage point, and so I don't feel as tied to saying things in a particular way as I might have done in school. Although, laughably, I'm probably less controversial than I now than I was when I worked in schools. I always thought, oh, if I leave, then I'll be free to say all these things. But I think I've mellowed. I think I'm incredibly, I'm all about human beings, really, because I just think humans are amazing. So <Yeah. laughs> I feel like I'm probably a lot more generous than I was when I worked in school. And what I realise is that even when I worked in school, I was passionate about making sure that the adults who worked in schools also were thriving. And I absolutely loved working in school. Like, I loved it. I love dining halls and corridors and playgrounds and oh, miss, those shoes are weird. Like, I like all those conversations. I like all of those things about young people. I love it.
Yeah.
And I also really, really, really like seeing adults having those sorts of relationships with kids. It just means so much to me. And so for me, I get a lot out of working, making sure that adults feel really good about doing it and doing this work brilliantly. And I don't know if I'm really a very good school leader. I mean, I think that there are so many really, really good school leaders. I know that what I'm good at is helping other people feel great about themselves and their work.
Yeah.
And so I don't know that I was best placed in the school, if you like, but I know that what I'm doing now is definitely the right place for me to be.
Good. That's good to hear. We've got somebody, it's a very long name, says me, but it's all letters and numbers, W2, W4, oh, that kind of thing. Okay. Says, fascinating conversation. How can I contact Nourished Collective?
Okay, so I think Nourished Collective comes up on here on Podbean because I used to have a podcast called the Nourished Collective Podcast.
Mm.
And I used to have a community called Nourished Collective, and that's now stepped aside. So you can contact me on Twitter, where I'm tweeting as Angela_Brown with an E.
Mm.
Did you get that double underscore, Mel?
Is there a double underscore?
Double underscore there.
Oh, I didn't spot that. I thought you just repeated yourself.
So good. They had to underscore it twice.
Right. Okay.
And
it's a line. That's what it is.
It's a long line. It's a long line. And I'm also on, my website is angelabrown.co.uk.
Fantastic.
So yeah, anyone who wants to reach out is very, very welcome to reach out to me there.
Well, thanks for coming in.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. So nice to talk to you over Monday morning.
Yes. I've had 2 hours sleep, so after this I'm just going to pass out.
I am loving your work, by the way. I didn't even really know that this Teachers Talk Radio existed until you asked me to come on.
Ooh.
And so now I'm going to be listening out for your morning show. And
check us, yes, and check out lots of shows. So tonight we've got Emily Follow Run Show at 8 o'clock, and she usually has some fantastic guests. Tom Hopkins Burke, yeah, give us a shout on Twitter. Tom Hopkins Burke, who's our news reader, and he has a Saturday News Hour show. This weekend we had a full weekend of shows, and if you go on the website you can see all the previous shows. They're all podcasts now, so you can listen back. Wowzers. And you can listen live.
Fab. I will do that.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, do give us a shout on Twitter and let everybody know about
us. Thank you for such a warm welcome, my dear.
All right. Thanks for coming in.
See you soon. Bye.
Bye. Right. Okay. I am absolutely shattered now. I haven't had to get up this early in over a week because there's no school run or anything like that. I haven't got the kids running around outside the door because they have to go to school. So I might just go back to bed after this. Those of you on the way to work, don't hate me. You've got the voodoo dolls out. Yes, don't hate me. What have we been talking about today? We've been talking about a number of things today. We've been talking about exclusions. Do you know, you've got about 2 minutes still to call in and maybe win that mug. 2 minutes, people. Come on, just give me a call and you can win a mug. So give us your thoughts on exclusions. Do you think it's... do you have a strong feeling about exclusions, that we just shouldn't have them at all? What are your thoughts on pastoral care? Do you think it's adequate in your school? I mean, I have to say, from my experience, when I started teaching year 2000, I did my PGCE, there were all kinds of layers of pastoral care. We had a school counsellor. We had learning mentors who were amazing. We had, you had the heads of year who had time to do their jobs. You had another layer on top of that, and so layers and layers and layers. And by the time I left schools about 4 years ago, a lot of those layers had gone, and unfortunately, a lot of the pressure went on to teachers and teaching assistants as well. So, so a lot of those layers have gone, and then you've got CAMs that are completely overwhelmed. What are your thoughts? We've also been talking about exclusions. We've been talking about, well, Adrian and I were talking about our school days growing up in East London. That was pretty interesting. And finally, we talked to Angela Brown. So, yeah, what an interesting show. There's been lots of people. I've lost my sheets here now. We've had lots of guests in. Unfortunately, we haven't had any callers in. Please do call. But I'm going to sign off now. Next week, oh, it's the birthday sisters week. Oh, hang on. Yeah, it's the birthday sisters week. We've got Dr. Emma Kell and Kelly Hannigan coming in. And they both have the same birthday as me. So it's going to be a birthday party. And no, it's not our birthdays next week. But it just so happens that they both were available on the same day. And all three of us have the same birthday. So anyway, I'm going to sign off now. So if you want to listen, do listen again next week. If you missed half the show, you can listen back in just about 3 minutes' time. I'll download a podcast. It will be on the website and you can listen back. And you can listen back to all the shows from the weekend. Emily Fuller Run's show is on tonight at 8 o'clock. Do listen in. And have a great week, whether you're at school this week or... if you're, oh, I'm just looking for the outro jingle. Where did I do? Oh, yes, there it is. Yes, have a great week, whether you're in school this week or just chilling. I'm Mal Krishnasamy. You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Live for the week, not just the weekend.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.